The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow today.
Aloha, I'm Braden DeVos and I'm back. Please support the homeless children. They're in danger. If you have any extra clothes or food, please give it to them. Now you're on with Jeff, the solar guy.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal on this Wednesday, June 18th. And we are broadcasting live from the Ka'imi Channel aboard the Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel, Falkor. This marks the last day of our expedition to Station Aloha, and we'll complete the third and final 2014 student cruise for Schmidt Ocean Institute and the University of Hawaii. The research vessel, Falkor, has been in Hawaiian waters since November 2013 and has led 2-month-long mapping expeditions to the northwestern Hawaiian Islands and a total of 3 student cruises devoted to oceanography training and learning. This last student cruise that we currently are on has involved a mix of both students, undergraduates, graduates, and postdoctoral fellows working on zooplankton. So without further ado, let's share a little bit about what we've been doing over the past week. First up is Chief Scientist organizing the research trip, Dr. Erica Gersa. Erica is a biological oceanographer and assistant professor in the Department of Oceanography at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So it's kind of a treat to be broadcasting live from that beach, something a little bit different. Your research focuses on ecology, genetics, and evolution of marine zooplankton. So that's really what this trip's been about. So for those of us that don't know, what is zooplankton?
Okay, well, let's start and focus a little bit on plankton compared to zooplankton. And so plankton are organisms living in the open sea that are weak swimmers. So they're defined by their ability to swim as being relatively poor in relation to the velocity of ocean currents. And so what are plankton can range from things that you might expect to see swimmers, things that are very small, like bacteria, to things that actually can be fairly large, like large jellyfish that may be up to a meter in size, but are fairly weak swimmers, so they would all be plankton. And so the zoo part of zooplankton just refers to the fact that these are organisms that are consumers. So they're in contrast to phytoplankton, which are primary producers of the plants of the ocean. We've been studying the zooplankton, which are the primary consumers.
And zooplankton gives the impression that these are very large organisms. They are so very difficult to spot. We've been doing that through the net and looking at things through microscopes. They're very small.
Yeah, they're primarily microscopic. So. They range from things that can be civil cell organisms like ciliates that are very important grazers in the ocean, up to things that I mentioned like jellyfish. You can have really large jellies and lots of things in between there, and the range of millimeter and body size.
So now you also have some very fancy equipment aboard to help you find these zooplankton for your research. Can you talk a little bit about some of the tools that we've been using?
Sure. So we have using 3 primary instruments or sampling techniques on board. And so the first one is called MOCNES, which stands for Multiple Opening, Closing Nests and Environmental Sensing System. And so this is kind of the most sophisticated of the sampling systems we've been using in the last few days. The second thing we've been using is a CTD rosette, which is a system we can use both to track environmental changes in the upper ocean and also collect seawater. And then the last thing is just have the simple ring nets, which have been used for hundreds of years to collect animals in the surface ocean. And we've been using those to collect live animals primarily for experiments at sea. And so just to comment a little bit on what MOCNES is, which is what my work on board has focused on, this is a system to give you a feel for what it looks like. It's a large enough frame, and it's got nets on it, and at the top of that package are a series of sensors that real-time information about the ocean environment while this instrument is in the water column. And because it's connected to the ship by a live conducting cable, we can also communicate with these instruments, and that means that we can actually open and close these nets at particular depths, so we can acquire what I would call depth strata sampling, which means we can sample specific depth layers in the ocean. So when you're looking at different depth layers, why is that important? That's important because in these pelagic habitats, or these really open ocean environments, the ocean is very highly structured in the vertical, it's much more dramatic than in the horizontal. So you can see if you look at changes both in physical properties of the water column, but also in biological communities across a few hundred meters from the surface ocean, you see much more dramatic changes than you would across up to 1,000 kilometers in the horizontal dimension. So highly structured in the vertical. So what kind of differences would we see between really deep layers and some of the shallower layers?
Right.
So one thing that's really different is the biomass. So most of the biomass in the ocean is in the surface, upper 200 meters or so. So you see major declines in just the quantity of organisms that you collect across depth. And we've seen that, I think, even just anecdotally in our mock mass material, that the deeper nets come up with many fewer organisms than in the surface ocean. There are also strong gradients in diversity. If you look at these communities, you find there tends to be a mid-depth maximum in what we call the mesopelagic zone between about 200 meters and 1,000 meters there. We expect to find more species there than we would either in the surface or deeper down.
So how far deep do you go with the mock net?
So you can go deep as you want. On this cruise, we've been going down to 1,500 meters. So we've been transiting 100 meters, kind of the epipelagic zone, going all the way through the mesopelagic and down into really the sea, the bathypelagic zone. Very exciting and relatively poorly studied. So
has anything really interesting come up in the Voss Nessus?
There's amazing stuff there. We've gotten a couple of really large things, large heteropods and anglerfishes that you saw, and huge diversity of smaller things that we'll be working on when we get back in the lab. So
once you bring in and collect the zooplankton, then what happens after that?
Well, on board, we've been basically collecting material to take back and analyze in the lab, and so for that question, I'm just going to focus on the mock nest material. I think Michelle and Kate, who you'll be interviewing, will maybe talk about some of the other sampling types we've done. The mock nest material, we've been cutting it in half, and that will go towards a permanent repository of the samples that we can use to look at diversity using morphological identifications, which is the traditional way of trying to estimate diversity in these communities. And then a second half of the sample has been preserved for genetic analysis, and our goal here, or one primary goal, is to try to develop a new approach using DNA sequences to assess diversity in these communities. So that's really one of the primary goals.
So why is it important to know the diversity of these communities?
Okay, so just to step back a little bit, why would you want to do that? One major reason is that zooplankton are responding very strongly to climate change. We know this is a particular food component that has seen very dramatic rain shifts in the past several decades, and there have been some really compelling data sets showing that. But one problem there is that to really obtain that data basically is difficult because it requires a whole team of taxonomic experts to do this type of morphological identification. And that means that we only have observations from a fairly limited number of ocean regions. And so the hope would be if we came up with a more rapid approach to assessing community composition, that it could be used more widely to track changes in plankton communities across a variety of different ocean habitats. So that's kind of one goal, is to develop this as a useful tool to bring plankton community.
I think that's really important to communicate, because oftentimes when we talk about climate change and how that affects our oceans, a lot of people don't automatically go to how is this going to affect zooplankton.
Right.
You think mostly about the corals, but this is all very important to look at everything and how that relates.
Right. So zooplankton are intermediate trophic levels in the rainbow web, so they're important prey for many things that might be commercially important, in particular in larval stages, so commercially important fish, for example. So they can have important effects on recruitment dynamics, and that's been shown that changing plankton community composition can really, for example, cause recruitment. So
So what was the decision behind doing a student cruise? Why choose a student cruise to study zooplankton?
Well, I mean, the importance of a student cruise, I think this has been a great training opportunity for students from UH Manoa. We've had a range of students on board from undergraduate students who've never been to sea before. This has been their first opportunity to see what that type of work looks like, all the way up from very beginning graduate students to senior graduate students. And so I think the range of experiences they've had, you know, is fairly broad. The senior graduate students are conducting experiments that will probably go into their dissertation, be an important chapter in their dissertation work. And more early stage students have been able to do some exploratory work and figure out how they might run the experiments that will make up their master's or PhD dissertation. So, and it's also been very valuable, I think, for everyone to get a feel of the model. It's actually quite rare to have an opportunity to take it out and have people exposed to how it works and get a feel for what the data looks like and the samples look like. So that's been really special.
Well, I know just from observing, I've learned so much, and I didn't realize how much trial and error goes to make sure that all this equipment works and really kind of planning. How has this particular been for you on the software?
It's been good. We had trouble getting the mock nest to work in the beginning, but we all put some effort into it, and it worked. So I think on all cruises, to some extent, you have to be prepared to be visible. So, that's a standard part of seagoing research, actually. Yeah.
And everyone has very flexible. For those of you who have had an experience on the science vessel before, it is quite a busy process. There are things happening 24 hours a day. I mean, I know you, Erica, work sleeping very much. You were working through the night. How do you adjust to that?
I think it takes a little while. Many people are on watch at night and will shift their sleep schedules so their sleep during the daytime. I think for the crew, the folks that are here long term, we get into a routine. I think for those of us that are only here for a few days, you can just run down your batteries for a couple of days and then recharge when you get back to shore. So.
Well, and well-deserved recharging, I'm sure that will take place. Thank you so much, Erica. It has been a pleasure not only to interview you, but to sail with you on this past week. I know you've been busy all day and all night, so thanks for taking some time. Well, we're going to take a quick traffic break, but don't go anywhere because we are broadcasting live from the software out at sea, and we're going to talk about Critters That Glow right after this traffic break.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
If you're driving into town from the west side, expect some very slow traffic. Give yourself extra time. There's an incident downtown that HPD is investigating, and the H1 eastbound is completely closed at Vineyard Boulevard. If you're coming in on the airport viaduct, you'll be forced to exit onto Nimitz or Dillingham. Middle Street Tunnel is closed. All surface streets that feed onto the H1 eastbound are extra slow because of the ramp closures.
You want to get solar for all the right reasons, to live greener and get your utility bills under control. But the one thing you don't want is to get stuck with a solar conversion system that can't keep up with changing electrical rules and regulations. So get a system that's future perfect, one smart enough to let you use all the renewable energy you can produce, plus store the surplus for when you want to use it. That's Outback Power, with exclusive grid hybrid technology backed by legendary support. With an Outback power system, you can have it all. Net metering when it's available or off-grid independence when it makes the most sense. Contact Outback Power Technologies for an installation specialist near you.
Aloha, this is your solar guy, Jeff Davis here. If you have any questions regarding HECO's new regulations for photovoltaics or solar electric in your neighborhood, as you know, they have new rules. Just call me at 554-7200. I'll answer your questions most likely right over the phone. 554-7200. And please don't forget, solar hot water, solar-powered pool pumps, solar heating, all that is good to go. I can handle any of those questions as well. Call your solar guy at 554-7200. Aloha.
Aloha. Hawaii's Tomorrow and Jeff Davis are looking for motivated people. Are you a writer? The solar guy could use some comedy. Would you like to intern? You know he's got room, so give Jeff a call. Jeff Davis at 554-7200. 554-7200.
Aloha nohoi kako, and ho mai kai nohoi praise to Jeff Davis.
You're terrible at this.
I'm terrible, am I?
I love you, Ruby. Aloha. Hi, it's Jeff. Aloha. It seems as though Hawaiian Electric has made their decision to slow down photovoltaic solar electric installation throughout this last tax season. Many people have turned to battery storage systems to save money on the upgrades and to beat the tax season. These battery storage systems are standalone. You're not connected to the grid. You do receive this year's tax credits for them, and you can install them in any area on the island at any time. It's a fantastic idea. Now, I'm Kamiyama Solar, and we've installed many of these systems in the past. If you have any questions for me, they can be answered generically with a phone call. So go ahead and get to me, Jeff Davis, your solar guy, regarding battery storage systems for your photovoltaics this year at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. Aloha!
Aloha! It's me, Braden DeVos. And again, I ask a favor. Will you help restock the fish on our reefs so when my friends and I go snorkeling, we can see Hawaii as it should be? Mahalo. Thank you, solar guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, broadcasting live from the ocean aboard Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel, Falkor. Joining us now is Dr. Kate Hansen, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Hawaii at Manoa in the Department of Oceanography. Kate has been working in Erica's lab, who we just interviewed, designing DNA-based techniques to identify and quantify marine zooplankton. Good to be here with you, Kate.
Thanks, Carly.
So first, can you tell me how you got interested in these small zooplankton animals?
Sure, I'd love to. I did my undergraduate work at UCLA, and we were very lucky as students to have a marine biology field quarter. And that year, we actually came here to Hawaii, to the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And one of my professors, Bill Hanner, was a zooplankton expert. And after a few weeks in the field and in the lab working with him and seeing these amazing, diverse organisms under the microscope, I was hooked.
Now, your project that you've been working on the past week on the ship has been captivating me. It's so fascinating. Can you tell us a little about the glowing research you're doing?
Yes, thanks, Carly. So my project on this cruise, I'm looking at plankton that glow, and more specifically, plankton that fluoresce. And this is a marvelous opportunity. A few years ago, I had seen published in the scientific literature a description of copepods that produce a particular kind of protein that fluoresces, or essentially renders them glowing. And at that time, I was living and working in New York with very few opportunities to go to sea. So flash forward a couple of years, and here I am in the midst of the Pacific, where we have a very diverse zooplankton assemblage, and this is pretty much the perfect time and place to be asking questions about who glows in the plankton and asking those questions in a way that we might have insight into why they glow.
So I'm very interested in this because I've been in the lab, I've seen what you're producing, and it's so cool to find these plankton. How do they fluoresce? How can we see that?
Yeah, maybe it would be easiest to start with a breakdown of light in the ocean or glowing in the ocean. So we know that marine organisms can glow in three types of ways. There are bioluminescent organisms that are more or less you getting to the backyard with a glow stick. Those organisms are producing a chemical reaction that generates new light. There are also organisms that phosphoresce. That's more analogous to glow in the dark stars. And I'm looking at organisms that fluoresce. So if you've ever been to disco bowling under a black light or elsewhere and seen your white socks light up or red or orange in your clothes glow, that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at animals in the plankton that glow. They're not producing their own light like the bioluminescent organisms, but they glow because they transform and re-emit
light that hits them, and that's what produces this light or glow that we see.
So are there other animals that fluoresce besides zooplankton?
There are. So what we know so far of marine organisms that fluoresce, we know that many jellies, cnidarians, and some ctenophores fluoresce, corals fluoresce. This is very popular kind of sport diving and also in the aquarium hobby to observe coral fluorescence. And slowly but surely, we're starting to discover more and different types of organisms that fluoresce. So prior to this research cruise, it had been documented at copepods, a crustacean zooplankton related to crabs and shrimp, fluoresce. And so we're out here on the South Shore digging a little bit deeper into that fluorescence in copepods.
So why exactly do you want to know about these fluorescent plankton? Like, what applications does that have to your work?
Well, even the fluorescent plankton are widely used in a variety of biomedical sciences. We know very little about why animals have fluorescent proteins. And the answer to that might differ across various organisms. Some people working in corals think that these proteins might be photoprotective, that they are taking in higher energy wavelengths of light and giving them back at lower energy wavelengths of light. But in contrast, researchers that study fluorescence in fishes think that this glow or this light must be a method of communication to be able to recognize members of your species in a field, or perhaps even a method of camouflage.
I love that. That's a cool idea. So are there better helpers or conditions for the fluorescing of these species?
Yes, the fluorescence we're looking at, again, it's all coming from a particular type of protein, but there are different, essentially, color versions of this protein. There are some fluorescent proteins that glow green, some yellow, some orange, some red. And we can characterize these proteins by their excitation spectra, and that's the wavelengths of light that excite them, make them glow. And then their emission spectra, and those are the colors that they give off. And for each protein, they'll have kind of a match of which types of light excite them and which colors they glow. And so a common pairing there is fluorescence that's excited by blue light, and then the molecule gives off a green glow. And out here in plankton, we've seen a mix of everything, lots of green, a little bit of yellow and orange, and even some red fluorescence.
That's amazing. And you've been looking at these fluorescents through a homemade darkroom. Tell us a little bit about that. That was very creative.
Yeah, one of the exciting parts of science in the field or at sea is that you sometimes have to make do with what you have. So luckily, Lauren, who you'll be speaking with, and a colleague, Matt, created me a wonderful darkroom inside an unused freezer and a trash bag tent. And the darkroom was important because this fluorescence, this light that's being re-emitted, is much weaker than the light we're shining on it to excite it. So it's helpful to be in a dark room to be able to observe this fluorescence. And you also need a special goggles or a special filter over your camera or your microscope or your eyes to be able to see this fluorescence. So you block out the blue light that you shine on them, and then you only see the red, the yellow, or the green coming back at you.
I couldn't believe it when you gave me those yellow masses to look at. Saw all those green swimming zooplankton in the bucket. It was quite amazing. I was very excited to see the results of your work. So what's next? You know that you collected the zooplankton on the boat and you looked at some of them under the microscope. What's the next step for you?
So the initial goal of this project was to really get out, have the right equipment and these combinations of light sources and filters to be able to properly observe the fluorescence and to discover who's out of fluorescence and take observations in a systematic way where we compare various species. We look for things like patterning among species or differences between males and females in a species or trends in glowers in different depth regions. And all those things give us little hints as to whether in zooplankton or copepods specifically, this glow is a type of communication, or this is a visual ecology story. And that's kind of our hunch that it might be a way that these organisms are finding mates.
It's amazing. Well, I can't wait to see what comes next. I just want to thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk to us about fluorescence and zooplankton and all the cool things you've been doing on board.
That's great. Thanks, Carly. Thank you. We'll take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, more zooplankton.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
HPD has just reopened the H1 eastbound traffic, no longer being diverted. If you got stuck in the townbound traffic, it is going to take a while for that to clear out. H1 is backed up to the airport on-ramp on the viaduct, the Moanalua at Fort Shafter Flats. Going west, the H1 slows at the west end of the airport viaduct, the Moanalua slows at Pu'uloa Road. Conditions normal to the windward side as well as to Hawaii Kai.
You want to get solar for all the right reasons, to live greener and get your utility bills under control. But the one thing you don't want is to get stuck with a solar conversion system that can't keep up with changing electrical rules and regulations. So get a system that's future perfect, one smart enough to let you use all the renewable energy you can produce, plus store the surplus for when you want to use it. That's Outback Power, with exclusive grid hybrid technology backed by legendary support. With an Outback Power system, you can have it all. Net metering when it's available or off-grid independence when it makes the most sense. Contact Outback Power Technologies for an installation specialist near you.
Aloha, this is your solar guy, Jeff Davis here. If you have any questions regarding HECO's new regulations for photovoltaics or solar electric in your neighborhood, as you know, they have new rules, just call me at 554-7200. I'll answer your questions most likely right over the phone. 554-7200. And please don't forget, solar hot water, solar-powered pool pumps, solar heating, all that is good to go. I can handle any of those questions as well. Call your solar guy at 554-7200. Aloha.
Aloha. It's me, Braden DeVos. And again, I ask a favor. Will you help restock the fish on our reefs so when my friends and I go snorkeling, we can see Hawaii as it should be? Mahalo. Thank you, Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us on Carly Wire, your marine science gal, broadcasting live aboard the Falkor Schmidt Ocean Institute research vessel, with us now is Michelle Youngwee, a PhD candidate in the Biological Oceanography Department at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Michelle, welcome to the show. So we've heard all these interesting things about zooplankton and all the different projects that are happening on board. Now, you study a very specific type of plankton. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yes. My focus of my PhD is zooplankton called a copepod, which is a microscopic shrimp-like crustacean about the size of up to a few millimeters. And specifically, I study the baby copepods, the earliest life stages called nauplii. And copepods develop through 12 different stages throughout their life cycle, and the first six of those are nauplii life stages. And I'm interested in nauplii because we know that they can be the most abundant multicellular organism in a range of marine ecosystems around the world, but we know very little about them because they're very hard to study, because they're much smaller than adult copepods.
Well, you're not kidding. I mean, these things are so small. I've been watching you guys, you know, go through the nets and looking under the microscope, trying to find the nauplii. It's a really dedicated task. Once you find this copepod, when you're looking at it, what does it tell you, or what information are you trying to get from it?
Well, nauplii may be extremely important in marine food webs. Because of their abundance, they could be very important grazers and important as prey items to larger things like fish and fish larvae. So with my experiments, I am hoping to detail what they're eating, how much they're eating, and how important they are in these ecosystems.
So we've talked a little bit about the mock nest, but we really haven't talked that much about this
thing called the CTD rosette, which you've been getting some of your information from. Can you describe what the CTD rosette looks like and how you're getting some of your information from this? Sure. This CTD, so what it allows us to do is it has this array of about 24 bottles arranged in a vertical sort of circular fashion, and they are connected to setters that tell us what the water column looks like as far as the temperature, how that changes with the depth as you lower the CTD. And using these sensors, you're able to target certain depths that we want to sample for Nalpii and close the Niskin bottles, the bottles that are arranged around the CTD, and bring it up to the surface and look at what it collects at each of these depths. So are there certain depths that are better for finding Nalpii? I know you were in the control room, which is a big giant room with lots and lots of computers. You can actually see what the CTD rosette is doing. How did you use that equipment to help you find those little critters in the ocean? Actually, when we first came out here, we had no idea what depth we would find the Nalpii at. Studies said, well, they're more abundant near the surface. And others said, well, there'll be more abundant at a chlorophyll max, which here tends to be around 100 meters. And so our first CTD deployment was sort of a shot in the dark, and we had to sample a variety of different depths and then look at how the abundance changed while we're here on the boat. And while we're in the control room, we actually get live viewing of how the different parameters, light and temperature, and the levels of productivity change with depth, and then we can we just click a mouse and that triggers the Niskin to close on at a time that will set the clock. It's amazing that you can collect all of this using such great technology. Now, I know you also did your master's research here in Hawaii and Kaneohe Bay. So how's the work that you're doing now on board compared to what you were doing in Kaneohe Bay? Can you tell me a little bit about that? Yes, it's very different from my master's work. That work in Kaneohe Bay, I was on a little 7-foot Boston Whaler, a little fishing boat, basically. I would go out and I would tow a net by hand through the water and look at plankton populations in Kaneohe Bay and how they respond to storm events. Yeah, and during master's work specifically to develop a genetic-based method that allows me to both identify the species in a sample and quantify its abundance using its DNA. Well, a small thing about handheld net is very different from some of the equipment and the boat we're on now, I mean, not far, it's 272 feet. So it is a big change. Is there a favorite part that you really enjoyed on this trip, or what do you like about being out at sea? One of my favorite parts of being at sea is just seeing the diversity of the plankton out here. When we do bring the mahas up and we bring the rinnet up, and get to look at the live, all different zooplankton, the jellyfish, fish larvae, and the copepods, and all the, and this, the most exciting when we have no idea what they are. We pulled up something that looked like a snowflake that had a behavior sort of a Venus flytrap. When it was disturbed, it closed up rapidly, and then it was slowly open, and then it closed up again. I had no idea what the thing was, but it was really cool to see. It really is like Christmas on board when Loch Ness comes out. You see all the scientists hovering around, quickly moving to get buckets out and pull samples. And then it's just, you know, you go into the wet lab where they pull all the samples afterwards. And, you know, there's all kinds of things that people are looking at and excitement and chaos. And it's absolutely wonderful. You can really tell people have such a passion for what they're doing here. How has this research or this exhibit in particular you make more strides or knowledge about NOCBI for your own PhD work?
Well, this expedition has been an opportunity for me to get into the open ocean because my master's and PhD so far is focused on Kaneohe Bay and that population. And just being able to be here and be able to experiment and discover where we can find the NOCBI and start to look at their what they eat and how much they eat and actually perform experiments out of the feed has really, I mean, it'll be a contribution towards my PhD, at least one, maybe two chapters of it. So it's a really exciting and useful experience.
And I think not only has there been opportunities to do really good things, but I think everyone on board would agree that the Salcor crew has been so helpful and they make it so comfortable. Everyone's so busy in research, they don't have a lot of time to do other things. And the food is very well fed and very well taken care of. Have you had any downtime now that we're done collecting all the samples, or are you just raring to go to get back at land so you can see what we've collected?
Well, yeah, this afternoon I actually had a little downtime. I was able to take advantage of one of the research hammocks that we have on and off deck. That was nice. I got to read a book and enjoy the sunshine for a little while.
Well deserved after 24-hour shifts and lots of hard work. Thank you so much, Michelle. It's been a pleasure to chat with you. We're going to take a really quick topic break, and when we return, we're going to be talking cocoa pod paternity.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Traffic slowly getting back to normal from the west side. The H1 eastbound was closed earlier for a police investigation, and that not only backed up the freeways, but it also jammed all the alternate routes. So if you're planning on coming in from the west anytime soon, give yourself plenty of extra time. Going west, typical, the H1 slows at the airport on-ramp on the viaduct. The Moana Lewis slows at Fort Shafter Flats.
You want to get solar for all the right reasons, to live greener and get your utility bills under control. But the one thing you don't want is to get stuck with a solar conversion system that can't keep up with changing electrical rules and regulations. So get a system that's future perfect, one smart enough to let you use all the renewable energy you can produce, plus store the surplus for when you want to use it. That's Outback Power, with exclusive grid hybrid technology backed by legendary support. With an Outback Power system, you can have it all. Net metering when it's available or off-grid independence when it makes the most sense. Contact Outback Power Technologies for an installation specialist near you.
Aloha, this is your solar guy, Jeff Davis here. If you have any questions regarding HECO's new regulations for photovoltaics or solar electric in your neighborhood, as you know, they have new rules. Just call me at 554-7200. I'll answer your questions most likely right over the phone. 554-7200. And please don't forget, solar hot water, solar-powered pool pumps, solar heating, all that is good to go. I can handle any of those questions as well. Call your solar guy at 554-7200. Aloha.
Aloha. Hawaii's Tomorrow and Jeff Davis are looking for motivated people. Are you a writer? The solar guy could use some comedy. Would you like to intern? You know he's got room, so give Jeff a call. Jeff Davis at 554-7200. 554-7200.
Hi, it's Jeff. Aloha. It seems as though Hawaiian Electric has made their decision to slow down photovoltaic solar electric installation throughout this last tax season. Many people have turned to battery storage systems to save money on the upgrades and to beat the tax season. These battery storage systems are standalone. You're not connected to the grid. You do receive this year's tax credits for them, and you can install them in any area on the island at any time. It's a fantastic idea. Now, I'm Kamiyama Solar, and we've installed many of these systems in the past. If you have any questions for me, they can be answered generically with a phone call. So go ahead and get to me, Jeff Davis, your solar guy, regarding battery storage systems for your photovoltaics this year at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. Aloha.
Aloha. It's me, Braden DeVos. And again, I ask a favor. Will you help restock the fish on our reefs so when my friends and I go snorkeling, we can see Hawaii as it should be? Mahalo. Thank you, solar guy.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. And if you're just tuning in, we are broadcasting live from the middle of the ocean aboard Ocean Institute's research vessel, Falkor. We are on our way back from Station Aloha. We've been spending the last week there sampling for zooplankton and are currently in the Kauai Channel between Oahu and Molokai doing some deep ocean mapping. And so we are currently above around 550 meters of water, give or take. With us now is Lauren Van Woutenberg and Astrid Leitner. These are two students who have been aboard the vessel all week helping with the plankton studies and doing some work of their own. Both oceanography students at the University of Hawaii. I'm very excited to have both of you guys here with me at sea. So, Lauren, let's start with you first. Why are expeditions such as this one so important for your work?
Well, expeditions like this give you a chance to really collect the animals that a lot of people don't have the opportunity to collect. And that's why we run 24-hour operations, because you want to get as much science in as you possibly can while you're out at sea. I don't know if Ashton has anything to add to that.
I think for a lot of us, this is really the only way we can collect samples, because we're doing blue water oceanography. It's not really close to shore. We don't have any other way to get out here except on expeditions like this. And so this is really a rare opportunity. And I don't know, I jump at any chance I get to go on any of these expeditions, because it is really hard to do and get out here to do these samples. And the enthusiasm that comes from both of you is just amazing. I know you guys are there pulling in the mock nest and, you know, are there front center with all the activities on the aft deck, which is the back of the ship where we deploy a lot of these large instruments like the mock nest and the CTD rosette, some of just our ring toes. What kind of learning experience has this been for you? Are there new skills that you're going to take away from this research cruise? Let's start with you, Lauren.
Certainly the mock nest, Astrid and I have a little bit of experience with that from previous cruise. So it was really great to kind of be able to help show some of the new people how to use that. But in terms of a new experience for me, I'm working on my own project. And I learned how to look for the very tiny nautilus that Michelle mentioned earlier, and that was a completely new thing for me. I've been looking at copepods, specific species, but nautilus are like even smaller than the small things in the ocean that you can't see. So,
can you give us a visual reference or example to how small they are? Like, what would it look like? Would it be like the size of a freckle or something smaller?
Well, it's smaller than all of my freckles. Maybe like the top of a pin or something. It's extremely small.
And what about you, Astrid? Is there certain things that you're going to take away from this cruise that you didn't know beforehand? Absolutely. So I am more of a macro person. I normally study bigger things that I can grab on to. So getting some experience with plankton and zooplankton has really a great opportunity for me. It's been helping Lauren chase down these mini
Malleae, and they're actually really, really fast. So only tiny and hard to see, but you have to chase them around a petri dish. Really exciting. Kind of reminds me of like a Pac-Man game where you have the Pac-Man going around trying to find Malleae, I guess, in this case. Now, Lauren, you talked about doing some of your own research on this particular expedition, Cocoapod Paternity. Let's talk a little bit more about that and what you're looking for. So this is really an exploratory project for me. It's something I've been interested in and I've looked at in a few other species, but I'm looking to see if in a clutch of eggs that a female will lay and then will hatch, if there's input DNA from multiple fathers. And this strategy, the mating strategy, is seen in a lot of other species across all different ways of life in the ocean. And it's something that can really increase the genetic diversity of a species and of a and really increase the fitness of an organism. So, give us a little bit more. You're sort of doing who's your daddy of Cocoapod Paternity. How do you know this? How can you find out about these paternities? So it's not something that you can tell from just looking at them. Basically, what we do is wait for the adult female to lay their eggs and then wait for those eggs to hatch. And once they've hatched, observe the Malleae and the adult female and bring them back to the lab. And that's when you get into the genetics part of it. And this particular project, we're going to be using microsatellites. And they're basically repeating base pairs on a specific spot on the genome. And what you can do is you'll have two numbers, and one is maternally and one is paternally inherited. And so if you're looking at all and you have different alleles that you're looking at, you can tell if there's more than three paternally inherited alleles, you know that you have more than one father that has been donating DNA to this offspring. So it's something that has said in quite a few other species. And so it'd be something really new and interesting to contribute to zooplankton research. It's like a fascinating project. So aside from being able to tell paternity of these Malleae or cocoapods, what other applications does this have either to marine management or for the broader impact of science? Well, so copepods are the dominant secondary producers of the sea, and as Erica mentioned earlier, they actually feed a lot of the commercially important fish that we look for and we want to eat, or you know, anything like that. And so, anything that you can further understand about the mating dynamics or the relationship of these animals is going to help put into perspective a new way to kind of manage the stocks commercially important further up that food chain. That's so interesting. And Astrid, you've been helping a lot with this project. What type of research are you looking at for your own work, or what areas are you interested in? I know you said you usually look at larger species.
Yeah, so I am normally working on mostly fishes and mostly deep sea fishes. So I have a specific interest in seamounts, which are mountains under the sea, and how the communities of fish and also, you know, other large species like deep sea corals and sponges are different on seamounts versus other habitats in the ocean. Now, most people, I think we talked about this before, haven't had the opportunity to be out at sea, and you two particularly have been very busy running around, doing all kinds of projects and jobs on board. Can you walk us through what a typical day is like when you're out here, so people can really get an idea of how busy it is?
All right. Well,
you wake up in the morning to your alarm and run immediately out to the whiteboard to see where you're needed. You most likely are deploying a net within, you know, a half an hour or so. So you have to rally the troops and get everybody excited and ready, have all of the nets on deck, work on the deployment, and then you come back in and we deal with the people that were tonight. We're monitoring the net while it's flying in the water. And that usually takes a couple of hours. And the net flies about for 7 hours. So we're working through it until the net comes back. And then you rally everyone together and in the back deck, make sure you have everyone you need. You have to prep your tagline. So it, basically, the recovery is something that's really intense. You got to basically hook onto the net and strap it down and make sure you get it back on board and safe. And then get all the samples back. So it's really involved. And by the time you're done getting all the samples back on board, you're almost ready for dinner. Somehow in there, you've managed to get some lunch in. And then you just crash as soon as you're done with your sampling and do it all over again the next day. You're crashing. The next group of people basically come and take those samples and start processing them and doing this whole cycle all over again. And those nets were flying, quote unquote, during the day and the night. And you know, the nets, when you say fly, so people don't think that that's flying in the air, they actually drop down, as Erica had mentioned in the beginning. So they get dropped to a certain depth, and we call it flying when it's in the water. Now, you talked a little bit about deploying and retrieving the nets, because this is sort of an interesting process. How did that happen? Can you walk us through that, Lauren?
Okay, so when you are deploying a net, like Astrid said, you have to have a lot of people that are ready to go. This is a huge, huge net. It's very heavy, and it needs to be stabilized. So it's being held up by the A-frame, but it also needs to stop, you know, as you're, when you're at sea, obviously the ship is moving back and forth, and you need to stop that net from swaying back and forth. So you need two people on either side of that also holding the net and keeping it from moving sideways. And then it's kind of a concentrated effort to move the A-frame out and keep the wire in the in one place, all the way until you slowly lower it down into the ocean. And then you have to slip your tie lines and pull them back in. And as Astrid said, recovery is kind of even more exciting and kind of stressful because you're pulling this net of the water and it has only one point of contact at that point, which is the A-frame. So you have to use these big hooks that are really long poles and reach it out and grab the net on different sides, pull that back in, stabilize it, stop it from swinging, get it on board, lower it, and then once you get it secured and tied down, you have to stand at the edge of the ship without falling off and pull up all nine nets back on the board. And they're full of water, so they're very heavy. And so it's kind of a rush. It's something that it's really possible to do efficiently. And when you get it done and into it and get good at it, and it's a really nice process.
Well, you both have been such a fun team to work with this past week. So I'd like to thank both of you for taking some time out of your sampling to come chat with me today. I also want to give a special shout out to Jeff Davis at Kamayama Solar, who has been instrumental in allowing us to this interview from sea today. I'd also like to give a very special thank you to the Sucker crew, who could they've been doing everything up us day and night and have made the science very easy. So not only thanks to them, but to the Schmidt Ocean Institute staff who provided a safe and comfortable expedition for all the scientists on board. I'd like to acknowledge Kosi Island Earth and the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Now, reporting from sea, I'm Carly Weiner. Get up there and enjoy the ocean planet.